This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. And this is Lydia Davis.
There are also men in the world. Sometimes we forget and think there are only women. Endless hills and plains of unresisting women. We make little jokes and comfort each other, and our lives pass quickly. But every now and then, it is true, a man rises unexpectedly in our midst, like a pine tree, and looks savagely at us and sends us hobbling away in great floods to hide in the caves and gullies until he is gone.
That is Lydia Davis reading her story, Men, the entire story, not an excerpt. Some of her stories are so short they seem almost like jokes or Zen koans, such as this one.
Bloomington. Now that I have been here for a little while, I can say with confidence that I have never been here before.
Even when Lydia Davis's stories are a more standard length, they're unusual. One of the longer pieces in her new book precisely describes three black cows grazing in the field across from the narrator's house. And that's all it does for 15 pages. It is amusing, then maybe a little boring, then kind of disturbing, and finally, when the cows go in for the evening, very and surprisingly moving. I will quote the novelist and critic Francine Prose, who said Davis's work is, quote, painstakingly logical, yet often veering more or less sharply in the direction of the demented. Lydia Davis's new collection of stories is called Can't and Won't, and she joins me now. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Demented. And she's a big fan. How does that feel?
I don't mind that at all.
Yeah.
I prefer that to many, many other adjectives.
A story like The Cows, the one I also just mentioned, seems like the work of somebody who spends a lot of time staring out a window. Are those cows actually next to your house?
They are actually across the road. I don't spend a lot of time staring out the window.
I shouldn't have said staring. That's an invidious version of looking. Yes.
Well, that would be fine, but I don't sit still. You're quite right. I don't sit still long enough to do that, but I look out often, and those observations were put together over 3 years.
That's why it's long. And would you, over those years, take notes, or just that was in your head?
No, I have to write it down immediately.
Yeah.
I don't retain things well in my head.
I have read that you don't like calling your stories fiction.
Oh, I don't mind calling them fiction. I don't like to call them short stories.
Uh-huh.
Unless they really are. There are one or two that I would call short stories, just because that term has its own history, and very few of my stories fit into that.
So they are mostly not short stories because...
Oh, I would say they're not 12 to 20 pages long with dialogue, setting, character development, epiphany, resolution, and concluding paragraph.
Very professorially and well said. There is a story here called Letter to the Foundation. The narrator is a literature professor who's won a big grant, as you did a decade ago, the MacArthur Fellowship. But she is this basket case, a kind of mess of anxiety and insecurity and finally guilt that she hasn't accomplished much of anything with her grant. Was it difficult to put that out there, even assuming the narrator is not precisely you?
Yes, it was a little difficult. In fact, the story was written well before the latest collection, and I actually decided not to put it in the previous collection, because it was just too close to home. But I thought, 10 or 11 years going by.
Who cares?
Well, and the narrator really isn't exactly me. I do exaggerate certain of
right.
my own qualities to make her someone else.
Do you do that often consciously, given that so much of your work is clearly transmuted from events in real life?
I don't attempt deliberately with that as a strategy, but sometimes every word of the story will actually be true to the facts, but the tone and the obsessiveness of the narrator who's telling the story makes it fiction for me.
Well, there you go. That's a definition of fiction. Growing up with a critic and English professor as a father and a mother who was a writer, do you feel like you were destined to go into the family, some version of the family business?
I'm afraid I did, and I didn't really begin to love it till I was probably in my late 20s. I had moments of great satisfaction, but I don't think I really was happy with it for quite a long time.
Really? And did you feel as if you were doing it because, hey, Mom and Dad, I just got to do this because this is what they do?
Well, not exactly, but it was what I was good at from a pretty early age. I knew I was good at it, and, you know, I still haven't explained it properly to myself, except the only competing interest was music, and I knew I couldn't grow up to be a composer or a proficient pianist.
Because?
Because I just thought I wouldn't be good enough. I didn't feel I was going to be good enough.
How and when did this very short story become your thing?
Well, it certainly became something I did a lot. I won't say it's exclusive, but I can date it pretty precisely to the fall of 1973 because...
That's pretty precise.
I have notebooks going way back, and I wrote in them voluminously. And so I can trace, you know, what I was doing and why very closely. I read a book of Russell Edson's prose poems.
You haven't finished your ape, said mother to father, who had monkey hair and blood on his whiskers. I've had enough monkey, cried father. You didn't eat the hands. And I went to all the trouble to make onion rings for its fingers, said mother.
He calls them prose poems. I would call them little domestic narratives of a very strange kind.
Uh-huh.
And they showed me what could be done.
And well, you were young, and according to my quick calculations of what you earlier said about when you weren't happy being a writer, you were still in your not happy being a writer period then, right?
I think that was the change.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You found your métier.
Yes. Yeah.
Huh.
I got happy.
And why did that click for you? I mean, you obviously like big, long novels. You translate them and read them. Why was this such a aha moment?
I think because of the compression, what you could do in a short space, it's sort of explosive. It was very exciting to me. But maybe this was my form of rebellion against my parents, you know, who both wrote traditional short stories. Maybe I felt, oh, I want to break free of that and go in a different direction altogether.
Yeah.
But I don't want to put a psychological interpretation on it only because...
Right.
I think it also might have to do with poetry, that I regard poetry as one of the highest, you know, forms of writing.
And some of these stories, or whatever we call them, resemble in ways that are indistinguishable to me from poems.
Yeah, probably my whole life has just been working my way from prose into poetry.
That's
know,
funny.
Without admitting it, you know.
This new collection, Can't and Won't, is divided into five sections, each of them containing, among other things, an eccentric letter of complaint to some organization or business. For instance, letter to a frozen peas manufacturer. Do these derive from some flicker of complaint that you don't act upon and turn into a story?
They do. And I may also act on them. So I may both act on them
really?
And turn them into
That's
a
fascinating.
Piece of literature.
Do you send a lot of letters to people you don't know? Well,
no. I don't
just
make
frozen vegetable makers.
That's right. I don't make a habit of sending letters of complaint unless they are letters that I've revised from these stories.
So you have the actual complaint, you turn them into your art, and then you say, I'm going to go ahead and send this?
That's right. Well, I have to revise it a bit because it just doesn't sound like a real letter.
Well, it sounds like a nuttier letter.
Right. I don't want it to be quite as nutty.
Huh. And do they always respond? Do they send other than form letters?
I got coupons for frozen peas from General Mills, and I think that may be the only response I got.
You've also got a series of what you call dream stories scattered throughout the book. Are they real dreams?
They're all either actual dreams or waking experiences that were like dreams in some way, but they're not all mine. Some of them are from friends, and in one case, one is from a letter.
Could you read one of the dream pieces?
Sure. We're about to buy a new piano. Our old upright has a crack all the way through the sounding board and other problems. We would like the piano shop to take it and resell it, but they tell us it is too badly damaged and cannot be resold to anyone else. They say it will have to be pushed over a cliff. This is how they will do it. two truck drivers take it to a remote spot. One driver walks away down the lane with his back turned, while the other shoves it over the cliff.
That is Lydia Davis reading a story from her new collection, Can't and Won't. Now, that sounds like the kind of only very slightly fantastic but essentially banal dream that I tend to have.
Well, you know, I don't reveal which are real waking experiences and which are not. That was from a letter written by my sister to my parents in the 60s, and it seemed to be the truth.
About how piano people do it?
That is how they get rid of a broken piano.
One of the things that strikes me about you is that you are this sort of quintessential arty intellectual, a writer's writer, a translator in multiple languages, a MacArthur genius. But your work is unpretentious. Is that just who you are? You don't want to have the obfuscations and pretense that other literary writers adopt?
I think it is just who I am. I certainly didn't make a decision at some point, well, I'm going to honor the ordinary.
Yeah, good. I'm glad to hear that.
I naturally find myself sitting and observing a fly. I mean, I'm interested in literary problems and problems of style and conceptual problems, ethical problems, but I'm also interested in just how a fly cleans its legs and so on.
But it seems also there's a basic kind of friendly posture toward the reader. You want the reader to get this.
Yes, I feel as if I'm sharing something, sharing a good thought or a good idea with a reader.
Any desire at all to write a novel or the big novel that posterity would then remember you for?
Not for that reason. I mean,
I
like certain very big, very ambitious projects. And I certainly have one impulse as in one of the longest stories in this book, the letter to the foundation. One impulse is to go on and on and on and on and on and include everything. So it's not impossible to imagine I might do that someday.
Well, I, for one, would love you to do that. Lydia Davis, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lydia Davis's new book, Can't and Won't, is out now.